The headlines: Iran says it will definitely avenge the U.S. assassination of General Soleimani as the country marks the third anniversary of its retaliatory missile strikes on a major American base. Thousands of people rally against the Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu in Tel Aviv, holding banners reading "Together Against Fascism and Apartheid." And China lifts quarantine requirements for inbound travelers after nearly 3 years following last month's decision to end its COVID policy. Thank you for joining us. My name is Gisumish Ahmadi, and these are our top stories of this hour. A top Iranian military commander has reiterated Tehran's resolve to take revenge on those responsible for the assassination of General Qasem Soleimani. The chief commander of the Islamic Revolution Guards Corps says this will be done sooner or later, and the perpetrators will be brought to justice. Hossein Salami hailed General Soleimani, saying the late commander was at the forefront of the fight against terrorism. The IRGC chief said Soleimani rendered the enemy's plots ineffective. Salami also hailed the massive participation of Iranians in General Soleimani's funeral. A senior Iranian military commander says the U.S. assassination of Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani laid bare the true colors of the American regime and unmasked its terrorist nature to the world. In an exclusive interview with Press TV's Insight program, General Shaqchi added that the terrorist and racist nature of the United States has even been revealed to its own people. He said African Americans have been mistreated and fatally shot on numerous occasions, as documented by numerous videos and images. Elsewhere in his remarks, the top commander said Iran has never invaded any country or violated the rights of any nation. However, he noted that Iran will stand up to global hegemony and any aggressors who have their eyes on its territory. He said the enemy intends to dominate Iranian people, but to no avail, as the nation stands firm against any such encroachments. Today marks the third anniversary of Iran's ballistic missile attack against the U.S. Ain al-Assad air base in Iraq's western province of Al-Anbar. The raid was carried out in retaliation for the assassination of Iran's top commander, Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani. Iran's Islamic Revolution Guards Corps unleashed more than a dozen ballistic missiles on the base. It caused significant damage, while the Pentagon said more than 100 American forces suffered traumatic brain injuries. The attack in January 2020 was the largest of its kind in modern history. Iran called it a first slap in the face of the U.S. and vowed harsher revenge in the future. The missile strike came as Iran laid to rest General Soleimani, who, along with his comrades, was killed in a U.S. drone strike near Baghdad Airport. General Soleimani played a pivotal role in the fight against Daesh terrorists in Iraq and Syria. We are joined by Sayed Zafar Mahdi, a journalist and commentator who is joining us live from Tehran. Mr. Mahdi, if you could please elaborate more on this retaliatory attack. Today is the third anniversary. And, of course, let's not forget that at first the United States tried to downplay this attack.
Well, thanks for having me. What we witnessed this day 3 years ago was truly unprecedented, and sent a strong message that Iran can strike and decimate all U.S. military bases in the region. The message went across very clearly. You know, the barrage of ballistic missiles that pounded the sprawling U.S. military base in Iraq three years ago this day came after prior warnings from Iran. And those warnings allowed the U.S. military personnel to disperse on the base and sent them rushing to bunkers, and that actually prevented major losses. But obviously, it resulted in severe brain injuries to hundreds of U.S. personnel. They almost were killed. Iran could have launched the strike without prior warning, and it could that could have killed hundreds of U.S. military personnel. But this carefully measured response in the form of these series of precision missile strikes on the U.S. base was turned out to be a game changer. You know, it came as a shock to military hawks in Washington, and it made it clear that Iran can do whatever it wants. But as the leader of the Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, said after that act, it was a mere slap on the face of U.S. military-industrial complex. The real revenge is still pending, and that is the complete expulsion, the disgraceful exit of U.S. forces from the region, not only from Iraq, but from all countries in the region, and as well as the liberation of Al-Quds, which was one of the biggest goals of General Soleimani and his associates. And that goal will be accomplished as part of the revenge for his blood, as Iranian authorities have repeatedly stressed. You know, we should not forget this assassination, this cowardly crime assassinating General Soleimani and his associates, including the deputy chief of Iraq's Popular Mobilization Forces, Abu Mahdi al-Muhandis. It marked a watershed moment in the fight against terrorism in this region. United States, which carried out the strike in the foolhardy manner, it demonstrated which side its military-industrial complex was on, the side of the Takfiri group that General Soleimani and his associates decimated in Syria and Iraq. And General Soleimani fought not only America, but also crushed Daesh in the region, which has been admitted even by the Western hawks. And it won't be exaggeration to state that he was assassinated in this strike authorized by the then U.S. President Donald Trump for exactly the same reason. You know, by defeating Daesh, General Soleimani foiled the plot of Western powers to destabilize this region, including Iran. And Daesh was basically created as a Western proxy to push the agenda of U.S. military-industrial complex in this region. Had this group succeeded in its mission in Iraq and Syria, obviously the next stop would have been Iran. General Soleimani was a master strategist, as we all know. He foiled and thwarted this plot and saved not only Iran, but all other countries in the region. This strike was sort of as a favor to this terrorist group. And Iran is well within its right to respond at its own time and place of its choosing, as we have heard top military and political officials in Iran repeatedly stressing.
Thank you very much, Sayed Zafar Mahdi, journalist joining us live from Tehran. In the meantime, Iran is also marking the third anniversary of the tragic downing of a Ukrainian passenger plane near Tehran. Ukrainian flight PS752 was en route to Kiev and was shot down shortly after taking off from Imam Khomeini Airport. All of the 176 people on board were killed. Iran acknowledged later that the mismanagement of an air defense unit's radar system by its operator was the key human error that led to the incident. At the time of this incident, Iran's air defenses were on high alert in anticipation of a potential U.S. attack. Hours before the tragedy, Iran had launched a missile strike against a U.S. base in Iraq in retaliation for the assassination of Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani. Iran has launched an investigation into the crash and has promised that all those culpable would face justice. At the same time, Iran has warned against any foreign political exploitation of this incident. Moving on to Tel Aviv, thousands of demonstrators have gathered to protest against the Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's new cabinet. The protesters held banners that read, "Together Against Fascism and Apartheid, Prime Minister." The protesters also denounced the judicial reforms proposed by the new justice minister. Opposition parties say the proposed judicial reforms allow parliament to override decisions of the Supreme Court. Netanyahu, who is fighting corruption charges, took office late last month, and his new cabinet is regarded as the most right-wing in Israeli history. The UAE's ambassador to the UN accuses certain states of politicizing a Syrian chemical weapons file. Lanazaki has severely criticized attempts made by certain countries to politicize the Syrian chemical weapons case. She has asked all parties in the Security Council to professionally consider the matter in line with the non-politicization policy of the Organization for Prohibition of Chemical Weapons. Despite Abu Dhabi's role in instigating the Syrian conflict by supporting foreign-backed militants and spread of misinformation, the Emirati government has recently adopted a diplomatic approach to normalize ties with Damascus. The Western media and governments have repeatedly alleged that the Syrian government used chemical weapons against its own citizens in the war against terrorists, and that is while Syria surrendered its stockpile of chemical weapons in 2014 to a joint mission led by the United States and the OPCW. China has officially ended its quarantine requirements for inbound travelers after nearly 3 years, despite struggling with nationwide surge of COVID cases. All travelers are still required to test negative for COVID-19 within 48 hours of departure. Mainland China has also opened its border with Hong Kong. Beijing last month began a dramatic dismantling of a hardline zero COVID strategy that involved mandatory quarantines and grueling lockdowns. The containment policy has generated resentment throughout China and has led to nationwide protests just before it was eased. Hundreds of Rohingya refugees in India are still deprived of proper shelter as freezing weather hits parts of the country. The poor community now has to face both the terrible weather conditions and acute sickness spread among its members. Manohar Zaman reports.
It's afternoon, and many Rohingya women are waiting in a queue to receive blankets offered by an NGO. Some are angry since they haven't received any blankets yet. Over the last few days, northern India has had freezing weather, and that has heaped misery of homelessness for the refugees living in makeshift tents. Zahid Hussain has come out of his shanty to have some sunlight. He says he's worried as his child has developed a skin disease that's getting worse and worse. He asked me to come to his shanty, where he is living with his family in appalling conditions.
My child is very sick. He got some skin disease. God knows what it is. But doctors say it's chickenpox or measles. He is very irritated due to uneasiness of skin. The day starts with his sickness, and all day long it's silently killing him with fevers and chills. Once a doctor from some NGO came here and gave medicine, but nothing worked.
Activists say such treatment of the community is against the Indian ethos of Vasudeva Kutumbakam, which translates to the world is one family. In recent years, a vicious expulsion campaign has shed more light on the way India treats specific communities. Rights activists have been urging the government to adopt a uniform refugee policy, which treats refugees equally, regardless of their faith or ethnicity. Thousands of Rohingya refugees in India are braving the cold weather and live in makeshift tents across the Indian subcontinent. These people, who always face the threat of detention and deportation, are here struggling for survival.
In this camp, children are getting sick and the sickness is unusual. They are getting chills, vomiting and fever. We have never seen this skin disease before. Even after visiting the doctor, the children are not getting any better. In every family, you will find children with this sickness. Now even women and men are getting affected. It's a very dangerous situation. Some say the sickness is spread to other camps. Doctors have advised us not to have guests from other camps and not to visit them.
Many refugees I spoke with shared heart-wrenching stories with me, and most of them kept asking why their voice is not being heard in the age of technology. Based on official estimates, India is home to some 40,000 Rohingya refugees, but independent reports suggest the real figure stands at hundreds of thousands. Rohingya Muslims are being treated as illegal immigrants in India and elsewhere After fleeing Myanmar, activists in India have stressed the urgent need to protect the Rohingyas' rights as refugees. Munawar Zaman, in the outskirts of New Delhi.
The UK Prime Minister calls for radical actions to reform Britain's crisis at healthcare system. Rishi Sunak made these remarks in an emergency meeting with the British health leaders. He said bold moves should be taken, like the ones during the COVID pandemic, to resolve the crisis. The meeting comes as the UK is witnessing a rare strike by health workers who want a salary hike at a time when inflation has soared to record levels in the country. Britain has faced a wave of industrial action over the last few months, with strikes crippling various sectors. Government is planning to introduce a new law that would make it harder for key workers to strike. One person is killed after Russia resumes bombing of eastern Ukrainian regions, ending a self-declared ceasefire along the front line that lasted 36 hours. The death was from shelling that hit the northern region of Kharkiv. Ukrainian officials also reported explosions across the border with Donbass, which has been the front line for months. The truce was announced by Moscow for Orthodox Christmas celebrations. It fell on Saturday. But Kiev rejected the ceasefire. The Kremlin now says Moscow will push ahead with the war until victory is achieved. That brings us to the end of this edition of World News.
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
Hame ba wujood ghudde saratani Israel mukhalifin.
All of us are opposed to the cancer's tumor, Israel.
Wajh mushtarak hame wahdat ummat islami.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
A few strive in the cause of God, victory will definitely follow. The following is a part of the speech delivered on June 28, 2022, by Imam Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, in a meeting with the head of the judiciary branch and a number of top officials and employees of the judiciary.
The fifth point is that no part of the powers or legal duties of the judiciary, as defined in the Constitution or related laws, should be suspended. No part of them should be suspended. For instance, the Attorney General has certain duties in the field of public law. He should have full knowledge of public law so that he can be sure that public rights are not violated. This should be taken very seriously, and the law must be resorted to wherever it felt that public rights are being violated. But I do not agree with the use of emotions and slogans in these cases. Rather, these matters should be taken care of in accordance with the law. This is an important task. There is also the issue of crime prevention. This is one of the duties of the judiciary and has been included in the Constitution. This matter must be taken seriously and not neglected at all. In the case of ordinary, everyday laws, the so-called conventional laws of the judiciary, I mean these laws that are about lands and which determine who each meter of land is owned by in cities and villages, these cases must come to a conclusion. They must be followed and finished up. If this is done, these land grabbers, these people who are thinking parts of the mountains and the like, will cease to exist. land grabbing itself is another source of problems.
دنیای اسلام یک نسخه امروز دارد و اون اتحاد.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
The sixth point is that the type of relationship between the judiciary and the executive officers in the judiciary is very important. This must be considered from different angles. One aspect is that the conduct of the officers must be monitored and supervised. Well, he just gave an order. I heard on the television about some of the things the officers are doing. These things should not be done to the suspects. This is one of the things that needs to be taken care of. The behavior of the officers should not be exaggerated, excessive, and the like. Another aspect is that the judiciary should not be influenced by the opinion of the executive officers. It is true that executive officers are effective, important agents, and they have certain powers. They have opinions about people and about cases, but the judiciary must act independently and not be influenced by their views. This is also one aspect. The other side of the issue is that these same officers sometimes have expert opinions, which are based on their research. These expert opinions should not be ignored. The judiciary should use these expert opinions.
Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. You guided me from all the ways that were wrong. Indeed, you gave me hope.
Wildfires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
The head of the International Monetary Fund, Kristalina Georgieva, has issued a dire warning over the economic outlook in 2023, saying that this year is going to be even tougher than the year 2022. That is because the U.S., EU, and Chinese economies have slowed down. The Ukraine conflict, soaring prices, and high interest rates, and the rise of the COVID have contributed to the slowdown in the global economy. She also said that a third of the world economy will be hit by a recession in 2023.
For most of the world economy, this is going to be a tough year, tougher than the year we leave behind. Why? Because the three big economies, US, EU, China, are all slowing down simultaneously. Half of the European Union will be in recession next year. China is going to slow down this year further. Next year would be a tough year for China. Mm-hmm. And that translates into negative trends globally.
Back in October, the IMF slashed its outlook for global economic growth in 2023. It blamed the gloomy outlook on the ongoing conflict in Ukraine and tougher monetary policies. According to Georgieva, China will face a very difficult start to the year 2023. That's because it is likely to grow at or below global growth for the first time in 40 years, she said.
China has slowed down dramatically in 2020. Two, because of this tight zero COVID policy. For the first time in 40 years, China's growth in 2022 is likely to be at or below global growth. That has never happened before. And looking into next year, for 3, 4, 5, 6 months, the relaxation of COVID restrictions would mean bushfire COVID cases throughout China.
She also said that the U.S. economy may avoid a recession, but warned a strong labor market there may lead the U.S. Federal Reserve to keep interest rates tight so as to combat high inflation, which could have negative economic consequences of its own. The IMF warning comes amid similar predictions by other institutions. UK-based Center for Economics and Business Research has said that the global slide into a recession next year, as a number of economies will contract due to surging borrowing costs introduced to combat inflation. K. Daniel Neufeld said, "We expect central bankers to stick to their guns in 2023, despite the economic costs. The cost of bringing inflation down to more comfortable levels is a poorer growth outlook for a number of years to come." The report is more pessimistic than the most recent forecast by the International Monetary Fund. Meanwhile, oil prices continue to slide, weighed down by China's rising COVID cases and a recession warning from the IMF. The warning comes amid a worsening economic crisis in developed nations. Just recently, Germany's Federal Statistical Office said that the country is grappling with its highest annual inflation in more than 70 years. According to official data, full-year inflation reached 7.9% in 2022 amid surging energy and food prices. The last time annual inflation was near that level was in the year 1951, when it stood at 7.6% as the post-war economic boom began. And the UK faces one of the worst recessions among the world's leading industrialized nations this year.
We're not the government. We haven't been in power for 12 years. Right, every aspect of society that's been impacted by government policy. 10 years of austerity, cuts to the economy, slowing growth, a badly handled Brexit, whatever your view on Brexit was, right, has all led to where we are today. But the fact that we've got so many people out on strike and so many people suffering, only the government can change it, or a change of government can change it.
The fallout from spiraling inflation triggered by the pandemic and the Ukraine conflict will persist for longer in the UK than in other G7 nations, and the country's recovery will be one of the weakest.
In November 2022, the Republican Party won the majority of votes to the House of Representatives. They vowed to go after Democrats and President Joe Biden, but now cracks have appeared with the party itself. In a historic incident, the GOP failed to nominate the House Speaker. Party leader Kevin McCarthy got just 203 votes in two rounds, less even than Democrat Hakeem Jeffries in the GOP-controlled chamber, and fared even worse, with 202 votes in round three. It went to six rounds, but yet McCarthy could not gain the votes. It was a tumultuous start to the new Congress and pointed to a difficult road ahead with Republicans now in control of the House. A new generation of conservative Republicans, many aligned with Donald Trump's Make America Great Again agenda, want to upend business as usual in Washington and were committed to stopping McCarthy's rise without concessions to their priorities. It is widely believed that a revolt of ultra-hardliners has dealt a humiliation to McCarthy.
Those of us who will not be voting for Kevin McCarthy today take no joy in this discomfort that this moment has brought. But if you want to drain the swamp, you cannot put the biggest alligator in charge of the exercise.
McCarthy became the first candidate to fall short in a first ballot for Speaker in a century. The impasse means Republicans are unable even to assume the control that they won in the midterms, as the new House can't yet be sworn in. The standoff over McCarthy has been building since Republicans appeared on track to win the House majority in the midterm elections in November. A new generation of Trump-aligned Republicans led the opposition to McCarthy, believing that he's neither conservative enough nor tough enough to battle Democrats.
And they even came to the position where one, Matt Gaetz, said, "I don't care if we go to plurality and we elect Hakeem Jeffries and it hurts the new frontline members not to get reelected." Well, that's not about America, and I will always fight to put the American people first, not a few individuals that want something for themselves. So we may have a battle on the floor, but the battle is for the conference and the country, and that's fine with me.
While the Senate remains in Democratic hands, House Republicans are eager to confront Biden after 2 years of the Democrats controlling both houses of Congress. But disagreements to choose the House Speaker is an ominous sign for the party and its conservative agenda. Even if McCarthy succeeds to be the Speaker, he'll be a weak figure who may be in office but barely in power. The war, which started with the Tea Party backlash to the Obama administration, is far from over.
We will compromise, but we will not capitulate. And there's a very serious difference. There's 222 Republicans in our conference now. So if 20 people are able to drive this train however they want to, 202 of us might as well go home, because that means they are the conference. That means they those 20 people will be the majority. Well, that is capitulation, and we will not do that. Compromise, yes.
The fractious support for McCarthy is over the direction of the GOP between swing district moderates and conservatives who have taken up the populist agenda of the former President Donald Trump. It is now believed that the chaos highlights the dilemma facing House Republicans.
You have 20 people demanding that 201 surrender to them unconditionally. Well, I will not surrender unconditionally. If you have conditions, give them to us. We'll consider them. Doesn't mean we'll do them, but you have to talk about them. But we've asked and we've asked, what is it you want? What do you need? But you have 20 people demanding the unconditional surrender of, including this group of warriors. We will not unconditionally surrender. Tell us what you want. We might surrender if you tell us the terms.
Analysts say no matter the concessions made to some of those on the far right, they simply will not relent and join other Republicans. The crisis is even more poignant as the party is set to brace for the presidential election set to be held in 2024. It now appears that fractures that Trump created within the Republican Party are deeper than ever before. With Trump still desperate to be elected president, it is unlikely the GOP will be able to unite behind another leader and change its electoral fortunes anytime soon. It didn't take more than a day after the most controversial and right-wing cabinet took over in Israel, headed by Benjamin Netanyahu. The UNGA acted swiftly and asked the ICJ to consider the consequences for Israel over its occupation of Palestinian territories.
Israeli practices and settlement activities affecting the rights of the Palestinian people and other Arabs of the occupied territories. End of quote.
It appeared as though the timing was pre-planned, and that the resolution was a signal to the new administration. Lots of cheers from PA Ambassador to the UN on the matter, though.
This vote and request comes one day after the new Israeli government was formed, pledging to accelerate colonial and racist policies against the Palestinian people.
It came as no surprise that the Israeli Prime Minister Netanyahu had the complete opposite view, saying that Israel is not bound by the UN vote. But does this resolution and referral to the ICJ even make a difference where Israel is concerned, or Palestinians for that matter? Definitely not. The reasons speak for themselves. As far as the ICC is concerned, Israel is not a party to the Rome Statute that established the ICC. This is while the International Criminal Court has determined that it does have jurisdiction over the territories occupied by Israel, despite Israel's insistence to the contrary. So what is the point of all of this if it won't change the facts on the ground? Well, aside from Israel not being a member of the ICC, it disputes its jurisdiction on the basis that Palestine is not a sovereign state that is capable of being a party to the Rome Statute. The UNGA areas of focus have been issues that Israel has not heeded, nor has it even taken into account. Violation by Israel on the rights of the Palestinian people to self-determination, as well as altering the demographic composition of outputs, is something that Israel has been actively doing. Not only that, coming right out of the gates, this administration has already said that it will go against the resolution. When it comes to the UN, Israel has had the most UN resolutions slapped against it, over 70 and counting. Israel has followed none. The Israeli ambassador, Gilad Erdan, has called the resolution moral stain on the UN. He said no international body can decide that the Jewish people are occupiers in their own homeland.
adding any decision from a judicial body which receives its mandate from the morally bankrupt and politicized UN is completely illegitimate. The UNGA resolution also exposes the hypocrisy of the so-called normalization of some Persian Gulf Arab countries with Israel. The resolution had virtually unanimous support from the Islamic world, including Arab states that have normalized relations with Israel. The new Israeli administration is described as being the most religious and right-wing in Israel's history. So extreme, it has even put it at odds with the Israelis inside of Israel. Additionally, it has rattled the cages of Israel's closest allies while escalating tensions with the Palestinians. This new coalition has explicitly called for illegal settlement expansion, the occupied West Bank, to be its top priority, vowing to legalize dozens of illegally built outposts and to annex the occupied territory. The incoming Minister of National Security, Ben-Gvir, who will be responsible for the Al-Aqsa Mosque, the Israeli police, and the Palestinians inside of Israel, has openly called for settlement expansion. Ben-Gvir also supports Jewish prayer at Al-Aqsa Mosque complex. Here's another point to consider. The United States, Britain, and Germany have opposed the UNGA resolution. The question that can be asked here is, if these countries voted against the resolution, doesn't that mean that they are in essence giving Israel the green light to go ahead with what the UNGA had proposed, like changing the demographics and the Islamic identity at the Al-Aqsa Mosque, or preventing the Palestinians' right of return, and other issues like settlements? The UK ambassador to the UN has already taken a defensive position when it comes to Israel.
We are deeply concerned at instability on the West Bank and call on all sides to work together to urgently de-escalate the situation. The UK will be voting no on the resolution. Israeli practices affecting human rights of the Palestinian people in the occupied Palestinian territories, including East Jerusalem, because we do not feel that a referral to the International Court of Justice is helpful in bringing the parties back to dialogue.
What appears to be certain is that the Palestinians may be facing an even bleaker future with this extreme coalition cabinet that has been formed. This can only mean that the crimes against the Palestinians may go into overdrive in this new year. And that is very hard to imagine, given that Israel has already violated Palestinians' right to such extremes that going beyond what has been done already is hard to imagine. It now remains to be seen how the world will react once this administration begins its work in the occupied Palestinian territories.
The United States approved arms sales to NATO allies increased dramatically in 2022 as the war between Russia and Ukraine prompted the bloc's member states into purchasing more weapons. By some estimates, military spending by the United States and its allies is growing at a level without precedent since the end of the Second World War. According to an analysis by Foreign Policy magazine, the number and cash value of arms sales approved by the United States to its NATO allies has nearly doubled in 2022 compared to 2021. According to an analysis of 2 years of data from the U.S. Defense Department's Defense Security Cooperation Agency, in 2021 the U.S. government approved 14 possible major arms sales to NATO allies worth around $15.5 billion. In 2022, that jumped to 24 possible major arms sales worth around $28 billion, including $1.24 billion worth of arms sales to expected future NATO member Finland. While not all arms sales will be finalized with the same number outlined in the proposals, the sharp uptick in these plans reflects a massive shift in Europe's security landscape. This has been the basis for the generation of vast profits for the arms manufacturers, with the U.S. military-industrial complex emerging as the key beneficiary of the war in Ukraine. Under conditions in which the Dow Jones Industrial Average has fallen by 10% for the year as a whole, the share prices of U.S. defense contractors have surged. Over the past 12 months, the share price of Northrop Grumman has increased 40%, and Raytheon is up by nearly 17%, while Lockheed Martin has surged by 37%. Some of the approved U.S. arms sales in 2022 were years in the making, such as Germany's plan to purchase F-35 fighter jets in a deal worth around $8.4 billion. But many other major arms sales were rushed after the war broke out in Ukraine, as European countries on NATO's eastern flank dashed to bulk up their own military capabilities in an effort to backfill the equipment they shipped to Ukraine and deter Moscow. The United States has already approved plans to sell HIMARS launchers to Estonia and Lithuania, and a similar plan for Latvia is expected to be announced within a matter of months. The major European powers are surging their military spending, with 10 NATO members spending more than 2% of GDP on weapons this year, up from 4% in 2014.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Movement.
Speed.
Live in hope.
Toward the pitch.
On Youth Station.
Youth Station. Youth Station.
I am a Muslim.
I am a Muslim.
Islamite.
Islamite.
Allah my Lord.
Allah my Lord.
His word Quran.
His word Quran.
Muhammad Prophet.
Muhammad Prophet.
Praise be upon.
Praise be upon.
I am Muslim for all of time.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of Youth Station. A very warm welcome to yet another episode. I'm your host, Zainab, and I have with me...
Asma, yes.
My favorite co-host.
I'm so happy to be here with you once
same
more.
Here.
It's always a pleasure, actually.
Yeah, same
to
here.
Share the table with you.
Same here, same here. So, Asma, when we actually start talking about the Holy Book of Quran, when we open it, and the opening surah, the surah Fatiha, or also called Saba Masani, or has many other names, or it's called the summary of whole Quran. And, you know, in this surah, we have one of the verses wherein we, Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala actually teaches us how to make dua, how to actually, you know, start talking to Him.
Yeah.
It's not just like, I want to talk to Allah, and I will just say, oh Allah, give me this and that and that and that. He actually says, first of all, seek help in my name. So when we go actually through the grammatical analysis of the verse, Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim, Bay in itself means seeking help from the name of Allah. Isma Allah, you know, the name of Allah. So I seek help in the name of Allah, who is kind, who is generous, who is
merciful.
Yeah. So then we have one of the very beautiful things in this surah, and that is, Ihdina as-sirat al-mustaqim. O Allah, show me the righteous path. And then Allah again answers in the very next page in Surah Baqarah, He says, Zalika al-kitabu la rayba fihi hudan lil-muttaqeen. This is a book, without a doubt, a guidance for the righteous, the pious, or those who fear Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. So actually, Allah is teaching us when you want to seek guidance, when you want to seek a right path, refer to my book.
Yeah, that is going to show you the way in order not to go astray.
Yeah, so this is, he's actually answering the question in a very, you know, when you seek help, he's again guiding you. Hudan lil muttaqin is what? What is the guidance for the muttaqin? What is the guidance for the righteous people?
It means that there is an instruction book for you out there.
Yeah, and he answers it very fast on the very next page.
So Zainab, you're saying that if we put this book in front of ourselves as a mirror, as a model, then we're going to live a prosperous life.
We are definitely for sure, but I am trying to say actually, we always say to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, show me the right path, and then we are moving like blind, and we are waiting for some miracle to happen.
Groping in the dark.
Allah will tell you, okay, that's the path, go on that path. No, that's not going to happen. He's answering on the very next page, refer to my book.
Yeah.
Everything is in the book.
You have to go and have some efforts and contemplation upon the verses in that book in order to get what is the true path and how you can achieve it and attain it.
All the paths are written out there in the book.
Yeah.
Like, is there anything that caught your attention, that actually taught you something that was very different from that no other thing could teach you, actually. Because there are parents, there are societies.
Yeah.
There are different online courses. There are so many. There are teachers, there are guides,
there are books and many things.
Who teach you this is good and this is bad? Mm-hmm. But was there something striking in your life about Quran?
And there's something very much interesting, Zainab. There are, as a literary person, as the one who's so much interested in literature, I have read so much of novels and I have watched so much of movies. But the interesting thing is that when you read a book once, you can never go back ever once more.
To read the boring book again.
It is not boring, you know. You know the whole story. And now you can go for the quotes that you have highlighted there. But you cannot go through it once more. Twice, three times.
It's very interesting. You know the language.
Yeah.
You understand things. And
fully.
It's something of your interest.
There's nothing hidden in it.
Yeah. And now, what about Quran?
And now, yeah. See the difference? We can... And the nice thing is that the more we read it, the more we go through different lines of it, we feel
every
more
time
attached.
Find something different.
Yeah, that makes it clear that this book is different and it has got a spirit. And they, as they say,
Allah
I don't
would
know,
have never challenged like get one surah like this.
Yeah, yeah. And we have it in our narration that God Himself said that when you pray, when you use your own language. To get connected to Allah, it's you talking to Him. But when you read the verses of the Holy Book of Quran, it's Allah talking to you.
Wow.
And it's very interesting.
Wow.
That feeling that you get in your hard times, in the dark days of your life, in the rainy days, when you think that, okay, He has forgotten about me and He is not close to listen to whatever I am saying to Him. Just thinking about this matter... And definitely going through the lines of this book, it would make it more even clearer for you that He is near you and He is listening to you and He actually is responding to your questions.
Exactly. Let's put it here and go for a short break. Dear listeners, stay tuned.
Inna hadha al-Qur'an yahdi. ويبشر المؤمنين الذين يعملون الصالحات أن لهم أجرا كبيرا.
Indeed, this Quran guides to that which is most suitable and gives good tidings to the believers who do righteous deeds, that they will have a great reward.
Thank you. listening to Youth Station. This is Zeta with
Asma. It's your service.
How Quran changed our lives, or how it has impacted our lives. So
yeah, and we were talking about how interesting is the fact that going through different chapters of this book is something that will never tire you out.
You always learn something new. It always adds to your knowledge. As a leader of revolution, Ayatollah Khamenei also says that we are very good in Quran. We are good in memorization. We are good in reading it. We are good in tartil, and we're good in actually, you know, doing so many things. But we are lacking behind in contemplation.
Yeah, which is, I guess, the most important one.
Yeah, because you gotta know why this particular verse is in this chapter. Why not in any other chapter? And what is the relation between the verses?
But you know what, Zainab? I would say something else. Sometimes when we think about something being done in the most and the best way, in the most perfect and the best way, we would put it off. You know what I mean? I mean that if I think, okay, I have to go and learn how to read perfectly like these skilled readers of the Holy Book who recite that with a special format that is called tartil. If I think that I have to go and read the Holy Book only in this case and only in the case that I contemplate for each and every line of this book, then there is this chance that I may not go for reading it at all. While we know that even reading the book and going through the appearance...
I disagree because when you start with contemplation, when you first start with reading, mm-hmm. and then you go for... translation, and then you go for contemplation. Contemplation is not something that comes at the very beginning. So you first got to learn reading.
No,
Then you learn translations, and when you get contemplation meaning, then you love to go through those verses again.
Yeah, I agree. But there's this thing that I wanted also to say, and it's about this modern life and how busy we are. And sometimes we don't even get the chance to read a verse of this book in daily, you know what I mean?
I think it's all about action. It's not about something printed on the paper. As long as this is not affecting your actions, it's not putting you into action, I don't think you're reading Quran. Even if you're reciting it each day in the morning, but you're doing something else, it's not changing your actions, it's not changing your life, then I don't think there's much fun in reciting it. You know, you take a basket that's dirty, okay? And you go and fill water in it. What will happen? Will you ever be able to fill a basket with water? No. Because a basket is basket. The water will leak from all sides. But at least...
the Holy Book is different. No. We have it in our narration.
Imam Ali Lissam is saying that. What I'm trying to say is that the dirtness of the basket will at least get cleaned when you go and actually try to bring water every day. But the actual meaning, what makes meaning is that getting water into it. And you won't be able to get water until and unless you actually take some other...
So that's very true. Yeah.
So yeah, it's all about your capacities. And there are so many different things that you learn, you get to know. Like I realized the importance of time going through Surah Asr. I realized how bad jealousy is that women have going through Surah Falaq. I realized a lot of things. And I'll say how. After a short break, what do you say?
Welcome back, dear listeners. Well, this is Youth Station. We are talking about the Holy Book of Quran and how it has changed our life. We actually went through too much of points. And right now, I would love to ask you, Zainab, you said that it had made some changes into your life. Tell us about those changes.
It's very easy to say that pin hopes on Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala only and not on people, but in practice it's really, really difficult. So I used to have hopes from people and I used to expect actually, and then I would wait for the consequences, and again the consequences would come negative until this verse actually striked me, which we recite each and every day, and not only once, not only twice, as many as times.
Which is?
إِيَّاكَ نَعْبُدُ وَإِيَّاكَ نَسْتَعِينَ.
Yeah.
We worship only you and we only ask you for help. So when we are saying to him, we only ask you for help, mm-hmm. Why should I expect one or every third person to do something for me? Seek help from you, but I am seeking help in my heart from so many other people around me with my expectations, not directly like just telling them, but these expectations means that I am expecting help from you in a certain case, in a certain manner, you know. This is one, like not to expect from people, because expecting is something that's very, very difficult to control.
And pin all your hopes on Allah himself.
Yeah, it's very difficult that you do something for people and then you don't.
And Zainab, there's also another verse which is so interesting. I don't remember the exact number of the verse, but somewhere in this Mahola book, there is this verse that says, if God backs you up, if he supports you, then there is no single one in this world who could drag you down.
Exactly.
And this is very nice and full of hopes, and it gives you such a pride,
back,
you know?
A back, a support that you have someone.
You feel like he would never let you down. He would never let you alone on your own self.
There's,
you know,
again a very similar thing that, to what you said. It's in the verse 2 and 3 of Surah Talaq, which says so many things. But the point that I want to mention over here is the towards the end of the verses, which is that if you only practice taqwa, which is you carry out the wajibat, the obligatories, and stay away from the muharramat, which is stay away from the forbidden things. So if you do this, this is practicing taqwa, to carry out the obligatory and to stay away from the forbidden.
Yeah.
If you do this, just this, see Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, how kareem, how nice,
generous,
how merciful,
yeah,
how generous he is. He's saying, if you just do this, I will send you from the ways you have never expected.
Yeah, I will give you blessings from the way you would never expect them. When you pin all your hopes on Allah, he would back
whatever
you up.
Whatever he says, it's all truth. Just believe in it.
Yeah.
Just believe in it, like all the verses.
It's all about the assurance in your heart. And right now, our time is finished for today's episode. It was such an interesting session with you, Zainab. I hope all the audience enjoyed it as well.
Yeah, and I would suggest audiences to go for contemplation as well after translations.
Yeah, that would be so good. Thank you for staying tuned. Thank you for staying with us.
You are listening to Youth Station from IRIP English Radio. Until another session,
I bid you farewell. Wassalamu alaikum.
Wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Assalamu alaikum, peace be upon you, and welcome to Eye on Islam, the show where we look at current affairs through an Islamic lens and break it down from a Muslim perspective. On today's show, we'll analyse what might be behind the suspicious murder of an Iranian Sunni imam who was found dead after initially being kidnapped earlier this month in southeastern of the Islamic Republic. So who was Molavi Abdul Wahid Righi, and why was he killed? This next report will shed some light on this upsetting episode.
An Iranian Sunni cleric was kidnapped and murdered by unknown assailants in early December amid ongoing Western-backed anti-Iran violence across the country. Molavi Abdul Wahid Righi was the Friday prayers leader of Imam Hussein Mosque in Khash, a southeastern county in Sistan and Balochistan province. Local forces had been mobilized to find the whereabouts of the cleric, but his dead body was found not long after his disappearance on a roadside with three bullet wounds to the head. Prior to his death, Molavi Righi expressed strong support for the Islamic Republic of Iran and admitted his views earn him death threats. Iranian authorities have issued warnings against enemy plots aimed at destabilizing Sistan.